flight disadvantage of a log periodic is it is gain limited. You probably can get 6 or 8 decibels of Yagi-like gain out of a log periodic. I haven't seen any designs that get much more than that. With a very long, properly tuned Yagi antenna on one frequency, you can easily get 15 dB of gain, and if you're willing to be very enthusiastic, you can get 20 decibels of gain. The log periodic rarely gets more than 6, 7, 8 dB of gain. That's about the max you can get. But you get a lot for your money out of the log periodic. A hell of a lot of frequencies, reasonably low standing wave ratio across a very wide frequency range, and at least throughout the middle frequency region of the thing, essentially constant gain until you get to the very high end or the very low end. Essentially constant gain. Takes up quite a bit more real estate, a little bit more wind load, but you're getting a lot for your money out of a log periodic. A few hams have used log periodics on ham radio. Many commercial installations, like some of the early FAA long-range communications to their aircraft, used great big log periodic antennas to make sure that at the HF frequencies, they could always talk to their airplane. Let me drop. And by modern-day internet, you Google the word log periodic. You're going to get a whole bunch of articles, and you'll see an awful lot of the theory of operation, the so-called tau ratio. In other words, the way you design a log periodic is you're going to decide, as you go toward the sharp point, what is the rate at which you taper the length of those elements. That's one of the main design criteria. And if you're willing to build the log periodic longer and longer from front to back, you can get a little more gain and more and more frequency ratio between the lowest and the highest frequency. Cute antenna. One of the many ways of getting broadband response. Back in the days when people hadn't yet discovered the advantage of building very large diameter radiating elements, which still most of the books haven't yet recognized that today. Of all the antenna patents that I've been involved in, many of them are very fat elements where people thought they wouldn't work, and boy, they work extremely well. Over to you, Lance. Kilo Foxtrot 7, Victor November Hotel in Reno. K2LAW in the TechNet.
I thank you, Dick. That was very informative. I've never heard it exactly put in that manner of zigzag redundant. That was kind of, well, only you, being in the antenna business, to come up with something like that on a long period. Zigzag till it's in the proper redundant. I like that. Very good. Thank you very much. That was my question. I have questions about CMEs and things like that, and a Carrington effect, and another effect of ruptured electrons out of the photons. But I'll come at that another day, because you're on antennas tonight. Over.
Very fine, Lance. You've asked a good question. And yeah, at least in the beginning, I better restrict everybody to one question. I'm long-winded as it is. But some people like that. Some people fight and say that, gee, I need all that extra information. Okay, the next person who signed in was Freddie. Victor Bravo 2, Victor Bravo November. In Far Rocky Way, K2RIW. Speak as loud as you can, Freddie. Speak slowly, and we'll get what you're saying. KB2VBN, K2RIW. You got it, Freddie. Barry, N2MB, is Freddy on? Are we just not hearing him? N2MB, go ahead. Okay, maybe Barry's not there either, so Freddy seems not to be there right now. Joe, number 2, Kilo Charlie 2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. You got it, Joe. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I think Freddy said he was on his way home. Maybe he didn't arrive yet.
No, that was Joe who was mobile. Although maybe Fred said that also. Well, we'll come back to him. We're going to go to Joe number 2, and then we'll come back to Freddie. Kilo Charlie 2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. You've got it, Joe number 2, K2RIW. Joe's in Harrison, New York, which I think is up the Hudson. I'm not sure. And maybe he's not yet back at his base station. Okay, I'm going to give another call to Freddie, and after that, we'll go to the mailbag. KB2VBN, K2RIW. Is there, Freddie? thing in 2MV.
Okay, thank you, Barry. Looks like we put him to sleep with all that large periodic jazz. I'm having some fun with you, Barry. And Barry, on a quick break, your antennas are all doing the amount of radiating you desire in 2MB, K2LAW?
Not hardly. No. I have yet to put the antennas back together on the tower, on the big tower. I started to do it. I have a 2-meter beam working up there. I've got to replace the rotator and take the 6-meter beam down. And I'll have 2 and 432. And a little while after that, I'll have 1296. So it's in progress.
Okay, your 2-meter antenna is working very well tonight. Nice, clean, quiet signal. Your audio is a little bit low, but you sound good. Good luck with that project. And I'm sitting here dreaming about some fantastic antennas that I want to build. But I got to get out from under some honeydews first, you know. The most important thing in the house is the fluids have to flow. both the fluids coming in and the fluids going out. The second most important thing is all the electricity's got to work. All the appliances have to work. And after that, all the paint has got to be on, the right amount of paint in all the rooms. You know what's going on here. Hey, John, you being a single guy, you don't have to worry about all these jazzes. You can set your own priorities every day, John. KC2WGB. Go right ahead. K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, you're right. When it comes to painting, I hire painters. I don't like doing that. Let me let it drop on to the first question.
And by the way, John, your commanding officer is named Cookie. That's the name of his collie-like dog. You got it, John.
Yeah, I wonder what she thinks, whether she's the boss and the owner or I am. I don't have that straight yet. I'm trying to figure that out. Okay, got a question on a dipole antenna. Let me let it drop again. Okay, this gentleman was listening several weeks ago when he heard about changing the length of a dipole antenna. This was, I believe, on 40 meters, not that it makes a difference. But you had mentioned that folding back the end of the dipole elements back on itself tightly is the same as cutting it for tuning. Even though the electrical length of that wire is still the same, he wants to make sure that will change the tuning of the antenna. Does he have the concept right? Back to you, Dick.
Yes, he does. And he's now getting a secret piece of information that, to my knowledge, is not in any reasonable antenna engineering handbook. What I have done on multiple occasions is I'm on a kind of a small 900 meg antenna range, which happened to be in my office, so to speak, where I worked. Between the desk and the conference table was a 3-foot distance, and that was my antenna range at 900 megs for 3-element Yankee. But I have on multiple occasions made a dipole at 900 megahertz out of fairly small diameter wire, and while I'm measuring its resonant frequency on a vector network analyzer, displaying it as a Smith chart in one case, or displaying it as an XY chart where frequency is horizontal and standing wave ratio is vertical, a Viswar chart, let me drop it. While looking at that dipole being displayed in real time on what you and I would call it an antenna analyzer, I called it a vector network analyzer, made by Roden Schwartz, with a long, thin wooden stick, I would take the end of the dipole and start folding it back because it's made out of skinny wire, and I could do that. So I'm out of the field of the dipole with a skinny piece of wood. It's a long skewer stick, and I'm bending the tips of the dipole back on itself. And as I do that, I watch the resonant frequency go up. It's a very interesting process to watch. You just begin bending the tips of the dipole. Now, at first you bend them at a 45-degree angle down, so to speak, the last 20 or 30% of the dipole. The tips, you start bending it down, and you watch the frequency go up. And as you bend it more and more, the frequency goes higher and higher. And when you finally fold back the wire
so that it's absolutely parallel, as close as you can get. So in other words, even though this was made out of, in some cases, enameled wire, and wouldn't even have to make electrical contact, it was purely bare copper wire, and I folded it back, and I made complete contact in the fold, then obviously the new length is the exact length that you see, except for the wire being a little bit fatter at the tips, and a little bit of extra capacitance, minor effect. But even if you did it with enameled wire, as you do the folding back process, and you watch the resonance frequency go up continuously, the more you fold, the more the frequency goes up. And you soon realize what's going on. As the fold becomes more and more extreme, as you start bending it toward, let me drop. As you start bending it toward a 180-degree angle of bend, the field being radiated by the unbent piece of wire and the field radiated by the bent piece of wire, as they start coming closer and closer together, they start canceling each other. The radiated field starts canceling. And as you fold more and more, the electrical length of the dipole decreases. As I said, you're not going to read that in any book, but you as a ham radio tinkerer, once you've got an antenna analyzer and or vector network,
inductance or the capacitance react.
Yeah, Barry is asking, what changed? Let me drop.
Yeah, by the way, the east-west link is not working, Eric, if you're there.
KE2EJ, Lou just told us the eastern link is not working. I'm hearing my voice coming out of the eastern link. I'll admit that the eastern link maybe is not up to full power, but I think it's working, Lou. Lou, back to you for a comment.
Yes, it worked on that transmission. It didn't work on the previous 15 transmissions.
Hey, Lou, look how fast Eric is able to fix that. So Barry is asking the question, is the inductance, the capacitance, or the resistance that's changing as you fold it back? And the answer, Barry, is yes, yes, and yes. Everything is changing. How much of which, I don't know. And if you try to computer model that as to a bent dipole, I think you'd be able to find out how much. But the bottom line is the frequency goes up, the radiation resistance stays about the same on the new resonant frequency. If it was a 70 ohm impedance dipole before on its lower frequency, you start folding it back, and as you completely fold it back at 180 degrees, you're now on a higher frequency, and it's a 73 ohm dipole again. Ain't that crazy, Barry, at 2MB, K2LAW?
Okay, I guess I'll have to look it up then to find out. But you're saying that the resistance doesn't change. The capacitor reactance, the inductor reactance is definitely changing. And at the same time. Okay.
As you're at the intermediate steps of that folding, the inductance per length is going down, the capacitance per length is going up. Somehow that moves it up in frequency. I'll admit it goes through a couple of other resistive impedances when you're in the intermediate levels of the fold. As you're starting to do the fold, I'm not sure if the resistive component went up a little bit or down a little bit. It comes back to 73 ohms when you've got the fold all the way back to 180 degrees, and now the new length is the length that you will measure with your ruler from tip to tip, if you know what I mean. You would think logically the signal is going to flow down the first piece of wire, go around the 180 degree bend, and come back on the folded back piece of wire, and you would think, logically, that the electrical length is still there. It's not. Almost all that electrical length of the folded region disappears as you approach the 180-degree fold point. As you can tell, John, your writer has written us a very good question. We've only got some of the information as to why Mother Nature behaves that way, but that is my experience on a real antenna range with a real piece of antenna analyzing equipment. That's the way it behaves. So you can continuously change. In other words, let me drop.
I had another little question on that.
Barry recognized. A good, smart mechanical engineer can come up with some kind of a folding mechanism that he can remotely control with some kind of a motor actuator or whatever. And therefore, he could continuously tune the frequency of his dipole. mechanically by adjusting the fold angle. N2 moon bound, KQLIW, wait for the beeps.
Okay, I think most everybody has seen dipoles where they have multiple ends. And, you know, and they don't come, you have to come back a certain length from the tip, from the end of the dipole, to make the new lens come out. And this makes the dipole broadband. So, how far back do you go? And how do you know how far back you go?
Okay, NY2HF, you've got very low audio, Dennis, but I did hear you. And we'll come back to you in a minute. When you start flaring out the tip of a dipole in multiple directions, they call it the capacitive top hat approach. That's a beautiful technique for mechanically shortening a dipole and yet keeping the electrical resonance. By top hat assemblies, you can make a dipole a hell of a lot shorter and it's still resonant. The Q still goes up when you do that. It does become a little bit more narrowband, Barry. And you can take the top hat assembly and not put it at the tip of the dipole, but back it off from the tip. And do you still get an advantage from doing that? Yes, you do. And the whole dipole moves down in frequency as you add the top hat assembly. And as the top hat assembly moves closer and closer to the center of the dipole, the effect of the top hat slowly disappears. You set up the dipole top hat right at the center of the dipole. Let me drop. You set up the top hat assembly right at the center of the dipole, and it'll act. The dipole will act like the top hats are not even there anymore. I wonder what that noise is. So, and there are kinds of antennas where I don't think you get any great electronic advantage out of doing it. But there are kinds of dipoles and Yagi elements you can buy where there are multiple top hat assemblies at multiple lengths along the dipole. Do you get a little bit more broadbanding out of that? I think if you do it just right, you can make the system work on multiple frequencies. Tell me how often you have seen these multiple top hats. Are they doing it only on dipoles? Have they also done it on Yagis, to your knowledge, Barry? N2MB, KQLIW.
Station point.
Okay, there's another station in there, too. I don't remember, but I believe I saw that done on a 75-meter dipole, and he came back about halfway down the element. So in other words, an eighth of a wave or something, you know, back from the tip with another piece of wire, and the other piece of wire was either shorter or longer, I don't know. But that broadbanded the dipole, and that was a little curious to me why that worked.
Okay, we're going to go to John in a minute. What do you believe is the amount of broadbanding claimed by that approach, Barry? And he added in an intermediate piece of wire, only one. And how much broadbanding did he claim, Barry, if you happen to know? Go ahead.
I think he got another 100 KC out of it, which is quite a bit.
Yes, it is. Go ahead, John, with your point of order.
Just to let you and Eric know, every time that noise comes up, we're losing the 900 link to the eastern.
Yeah, I'm going to listen a little bit right now. Right now, the 900 leg link is kind of noisy. I'm hearing a tapping sound in there, among other things. But if you give us enough audio, I think we're going to be able to hear you, Dennis. NY2HF, K2RAW. Go ahead, Dennis.
Thank you, Dick. I just wanted to say that what's happening on the eastern end getting lots of clicks and pops, and it's almost like crashing waves in the ocean. You're being muffled by hissing sounds. So it's not really happening, not on the eastern end. It's really hard and audible to the town. So it almost sounds like a car alternator that's not working properly for a mobile rig. It's clicks and pops, and in and out. Just to let you know, back to that, NY2HF.
Yeah, I'm not hearing that noise on 375, by the way, only on 250.
Yeah, during that transmission of Dennis, when I listened to Dennis on 375, he was quite clean. When I listened to him on 85, a lot of clicks and pops and other noises are in there. So the 900 meg link, I know that Eric has been working on it a lot over the last couple of weeks, and all the bugs in that out of it, yes. He's got a very difficult environment where on each end, where each antenna is located, the 900 meg link is being subjected to a hell of a lot of other nearby electronics on nearby frequencies, high-power digital-like electronics. So to try to make a clean link in those very busy environments at 900 megs is one hell of a challenge. I think it's going to require an extremely high-Q set of filters on each end so that only the desired frequency comes through and everything else is rejected by a zillion dBs. That's one possible approach to this because of the severity. He's in radio-wise a very hot environment on that link, so he's got quite a challenge. So I think, yeah, so the folding of the tips, let me drop. The folding of the tips of a dipole, as you fold back at a greater and greater angle, the electrical length of the dipole continuously decreases. The frequency of resonance, the frequency of operation, so to speak, continuously goes up. Your next question is, does it go up in a linear manner? No, it does not. But it goes up continuously, always in one direction. It's a monotonic variation, if you know what that means. So as you remotely fold the tips of the dipole, oh boy, as you remotely fold the tips of the dipole, you'll see the frequency continuously go up. And when you've got it folded back all the way at the 180-degree point, even though it's enameled wire and the foldback region is not making electrical contact along that length, you would think that the actual length would still be there. It's not. From my experience, it's as if the piece of wire didn't have the enamel insulation and as if you soldered the folded back region, if you know what I mean. It electronically acts that way. I never would have predicted that if I didn't see it with my own eyes. KC2WGB, another one of the things you discover when you're a tinkerer, K2IIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, just to make it a little clearer, I imagine once it is completely folded back upon itself, if you fold it back a 3-inch piece, you would lose 6 inches of radiation because of the magnetic canceling. Is that correct?
I'm glad you asked that question, John. No. If my dipole started off, let me pick a number, 12 inches long, and I took 3 inches on the right-hand side and folded it back, I have removed 3 inches from the length. I then take 3 inches on the left-hand side and fold it back. I have lost 3 inches of length. So now when I fold both right-hand side by 3 inches and left-hand side by 3 inches, I've lost 6 inches of the length of the dipole. The dipole is now, I hope I got the numbers right. Yeah, I think the dipole is now 6 inches long total. You can see what I mean. The amount of distance from the fold point out, as you make the fold more and more severe toward 180 degrees, that amount of length, eventually when you fold back at the 180 degree point, is essentially the same as going out there with a set of side cutters and cutting off 3 inches. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, but if we have a 3-inch piece folded back and that has a counter influence on the magnetic radiation and that's what's causing the canceling, we don't lose the complete 6 inches? That's a hard concept to follow. Maybe you could explain that.
I might not be able to explain it, John. That's what I observed. Now, I called it magnetic cancellation. Obviously, it's more complicated than that. It's obviously more complicated.
Okay.
What I think is going on, I know I heard you say okay. I think the signal flows down the straight piece of wire, comes to the folded back region. Because the folded back region, in my example, is a 180-degree fold, we're now Those two pieces of wire in the folded region are thoroughly parallel to each other with a very small distance between them, even though it's enameled wire. That signal flowing down the wire gets to the region of the tip of the foldback, and now that signal continues to flow down both pieces of wire on the original first pass of that signal. Because of the very strong capacitive coupling effect of the foldback region, when it's really folded back 180 degrees and thoroughly parallel, the capacitive coupling between the two is so strong that radio-wise it acts like one piece of wire in that region, even though there are two parallel pieces of wire. That's the way it acts. When you make that measurement and you watch it on the screen, KC2WGB, KQRIW. Go ahead, Eric.
Could you do me a favor, Dick, and listen to 8-5, and then listen to 3-7-5, and tell me which went louder?
Roger, Dodger. Okay, I'm listening on 8-5, I'm listening on 3-7-5, I'm listening on 8-5, I'm listening on 3-7-5. Very close. 3-7-5 might be a tiny bit lower, Eric, go ahead.
Okay, let's see, direction. I'm worried about my direction, but go ahead. Do it again.
Yeah, Eric, in your case, that's not true.
Yeah, I'm going to listen right now. When I transmit on 8.5, I'm listening on 8.5, I'm listening on 3.75. 3.75 is a tiny bit lower. I presume you're out at 3.75, and now I'm going to compare the audio out of both. Why don't you give me another transmission error? KE2EJ, KQLAW.
Hi, KQRIW, KE2J. Why don't you listen to 3-7-5 now, and now switch over to 8-5 and tell me which one's different.
Yeah, I agree with what John just said. When I listen to you on 3-7-5, I hear a fairly nice volume. And when I listen to you on that link, 8-5, you're 2.5 dB louder. So going to the west, you're louder. When I go from west to east, I'm a tiny bit lower in volume. Over to you, Eric.
Okay, you say about 2 dB louder. How is this now? K2RIW, K3J, sorry to do this to you, but it's the only time I get to play.
Okay, 8.5 is still a tiny bit louder than 3.75. Not much, but 8.5 is a little louder than 3.75 when you talk.
Okay, let's do this. Oh, okay, how about now? K2RIW, K2J.
8.5 is still quite loud, 3.75 is a little bit lower. Whatever knob you are turning, I think you were turning down the volume of 3.75 and 8.5, I'm not sure was coming down. Eric, go ahead.
Okay, what I'm doing is reducing the amount of audio of going to 8.5. Okay, now listen to 3.75 and listen to 8.5 and tell me what you hear.
You're now very close. 3.75 is a tiny bit lower than 8.5, but they're very close, Eric. Go ahead.
NY2HF, all right, Dick. That's good enough for now. I changed the exciter here, so... the amount of that spectrum that's in this environment is ridiculous. You could try narrow filters once, but, you know, that spectrum's peak is just everywhere.
Yeah, I know you've got a very difficult job there. NY2HF, go ahead, Dennis. I know you want to make a comment. K2LIW.
Thank you, Nick. Listen, the audio is just right on right now. It's really good. So whatever you did is working fabulously. It's increased. It's more legible. So don't touch your thing. Back to that.
By the way, I'm listening to your signal direct on 3.75, and you've got some kind of noise in the background there. But, you know, as they say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Dick? Yeah, out of curiosity, Dennis, are you transmitting on the 3.75 frequency directly? Because from Cutchogue, where you live on the North Fork, all the way down to where the 3.75 machine is, you still got a pretty long haul if you're doing it RF-wise. NY2HF or K2LIW?
Dick, I'm transmitting on 3.75 direct. I have I'm on the highest point of North Fork, and I'm also have a Rico Ranger up on the chimney mount, about 15, 20 feet above that. So, yeah, I'm reaching you through the repeater in Selden.
Yeah, and from your QTH in Cutshaw to Selden is a pretty long haul by my standards. So very well done. And the only way you could do it better is if you wanted to aim a Yagi in that direction, a quasi-vertically polarized Yagi. Okay, John, that was question number one, and so it's different than expectation. You actually go and make the measurement, and I never would have guessed that that's the answer when you did it with enameled wire. If I did it with bare wire, I'd expect that result. But with enameled wire, I get the exact same result as if it was bare wire. When I fold it back at 180 degrees, a hard fold, and the wires are thoroughly parallel, then it's as if that folded back region got cut away with a set of side cutters. As I said, I never would have predicted that. And explaining it, the best explanation I've got is very strong capacitive coupling makes those two pieces of parallel wire act like one piece of wire. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the Tech Man.
KC2WGB. Well, I guess the only way to prove the concept would be to do that experiment and then clip that 3-inch piece off and see if it still maintains resonance. How does that sound?
It turns out I've done that exact experiment, John. And as I fold back the enameled wire, and it's a very tight fold, and they're very parallel, and then I use a set of side cutters and very carefully cut away that tip. When I do that, the frequency goes up very, very slightly. And the reason for that, in my opinion, is that before I cut it, it acted like one simple piece of wire, except the piece of wire was twice as fat near the tip. That gives you a little bit of extra tip capacitance. And when I cut away the folded back piece of wire, I went up another 1 or 2%, so to speak, a very small amount that went up because of the fatness of the wire, not because the signal really flows back in the 180 degree direction, if you know what I mean.
I did this in the center of the dipole, the feed point, assuming feeding at the center. Same thing, like you're doing at the tips, would you get the same effect?
Okay, I know you want to do some kind of a folding near the center of the dipole. And are you telling me you're going to make a Z-fold in the center of the dipole? Is that what you're saying, Barry? Go ahead.
No. You were saying that you take the end of the dipole and you fold it over. And as you fold it back on itself, the element essentially becomes shorter and shorter. It acts like the element is shorter and shorter until finally it's folded over completely on itself. I want to do the exact same thing in the center of the dipole, assuming you're feeding it with, like, coax or something, you know. So it's a center-fed dipole, you know, and do the very same thing. It's just, you know, come back and fold it over, and if you didn't fold it over, would it still be the same length? You know what I'm saying?
No, I don't know what you're saying. In my experiment, Barry, I had a dipole operating with the right kind of a balance on a real antenna range with real instrumentation connected to it, and because it was small diameter wire and with a little bit of pre-bending with my fingers to start the bending process, then with these thin, long sticks, without interfering with the field, I could fold back the tips. How in the world could I do that folding mechanism that I think you're trying to describe with my thin, long sticks at the center of the dipole? How in the world would I do that, Barry? You may have a picture in your mind, but your words didn't convey it yet. N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW.
Dick, I think he means to move the connection point at the center up 3 inches. I think that's what Barry's claiming.
Yes, that's true. I'm moving the connection point, like let's assume you come through it with open wire line, and you move your connection point not at the end of the wire, but move it in a little bit, you know, 2 or 3 or 6 inches, whatever, from the end. Now, assuming this is a dipole, it's not connected straight through, so it's cut there, it's a dipole, okay? And you're going to fold this end over after you've done this connection. So You know what I'm saying? I think somebody knows what I'm saying.
Are you saying you're making the center of the dipole look like the gold wing of an F4U aircraft? Is that the way you're folding the center? Go ahead.
Think so. I have to remember what that looks like. Now remember now, you're not feeding the dipole at its very end in the middle. You're feeding it a few inches out. This gives you the ability to take that end and fold it over, if you see what I'm saying.
Okay. When I do your particular center feeding arrangement, is it starting to look like a delta fed dipole? Over to you, Barry.
I'm not sure what a delta fed dipole is. I had to look at that on a piece of paper, so I can't answer that. I'm not sure.
Okay, and a pure delta fed dipole, the real dipole radiator has no center insulator. The wire goes all the way straight through the center. However, you're feeding with something that looks like twin lead, and if you were doing this on 2 meters, the twin lead would come up to the vicinity of the dipole, and when you were about 4 inches from the dipole, you would start splitting the twin lead. The right hand side is curved to the right, left hand side is curved to the left, and so at some distance downrange from the center, you solder the twin lead to the dipole. That's a delta-fed dipole. Now, I know that you have a center insulator in your example, so if I now took that delta-fed dipole I just described and added a center insulator, would be that what you're talking about? So therefore, it's the equivalent of making a gold wing fold, a dihedral fold if it was the wing of an airplane near the center. Is that what you're describing, Barry? Go ahead.
That's exactly what I'm saying. And the reason why we weren't communicating was because I had already assumed that center was cut, so it wouldn't have been a delta feed anymore.
Okay. As you do that kind of a fold that you're describing, you are electronically shortening the dipole, I believe, and I think you will move it to a higher frequency. However, the flare out of your twin lead is itself another Z0 transmission line. If you started off with 300 ohm twin lead, in the areas where you flared it out, it's now becoming 600 ohm twin lead. So now you're doing another kind of quarter wave matching transformer-like phenomena, even though it's less than a quarter wave. So a number of things are happening simultaneously. Dipole itself is going to act a little bit higher in frequency, but you're adding another impedance match device, and let me think about that one. A higher impedance match, shorter than quarter wave, I think will make the apparent impedance lower. I think your 70 ohms will start looking like 50 ohms when you do that. N2MB, K2LIW.
Okay, that could be very useful. Okay. I won't bore you with any more of that. I have another one, but I think I'll let it go. I was essentially thinking a fan dipole now. It's another project, but a fan dipole, where you essentially have two dipoles, full length, let's say any band, doesn't matter, but one dipole is cut 200 kc's lower in the band than the other one. So it's essentially two dipoles, like a fan dipole, and of course it's going to pick its frequency. But my question is, when you take one of those dipoles, and instead of connecting it right at the end, so it's a fan dipole, you move it up the element a little bit. When does this start to not work?
It would never stop working, Barry. No matter how you zigzag the dipole itself, make it go wing in the center, delta-like feed, with or without center insulator, zigzag somewhere downrange, tilt, make the tips of fan dipole, or bend the tips down. There's a zillion ways you can zigzag, add inductors, add capacitors, add all kinds of things to a dipole. Every single one of them will work. It doesn't stop working. However, as you do all these modifications and you're watching the result on a Smith chart, or a antenna analyzer, where you're continuously looking at the resistive component and the reactive component of the impedance of the dipole that you're modifying. That impedance is going to slowly go up and down. The reactance is going to rapidly go up and down at your frequency. That's a fancy way of saying you've got a new resonant frequency. So you've got a zillion ways of bending, tilting, folding, adding devices, adding capacitors, adding inductors, whatever, to a dipole. Every one of them works. Let me drop. It never stops working. It has a brand new resonant frequency. It's got a brand new impedance. And as long as you properly resonate that thing and impedance match that impedance, it will radiate 90% of your energy. It never stops working. It may go over to an impedance you don't like, a reactance you don't like, and maybe you don't want to go through all the effort of re-impedance matching that to build an antenna tuner with enough range to do that. But it never stops working. As long as it is an exposed piece of wire, so to speak, it may not be wire, but as long as it's an exposed thing, exposed to the air that is resonant, it will radiate. It has no choice. No book says that. I believe that's the bedrock of the antenna dipole science. Ain't that crazy? N2 Moonbounce, K2LAW.
Okay, I think Eric just changed something because that was a very different sound. Okay, I am going to beat this to death next week. So be ready because I got a few more questions. I don't want to bore everybody to death tonight. Back over to you. N2 Meatball, Rockaway Beach.
Now, don't worry, Barry. My latest philosophy is the most basic antenna on planet Earth is dipole and all of its cousins. Dipole, monopole, folded F, patch antenna. Dipole-driven element of a log periodic. Dipole-driven element of a Yagi. Monopole, monopole that's the driven element of a waveguide to coax adapter. Monopole that's the feeding probe of a feed on. Almost all the antennas that we work with eventually come back to dipole or half dipole, which is monopole, to study what is really happening at the molecular level, so to speak, of a dipole slash monopole-like structure. In my opinion, is an extremely valuable thing to research. And as you research that, you get down to the real basic knowledge of what's going on when you radiate a radio signal. It's what you really want to know. That's where the rubber meets the road. Let me drop. As I said, that's where the rubber meets the road. And because of the way we teach wireless engineering in our schools, and because of the way our antenna books and radio books are written, this jazz is never there. You take a seasoned antenna engineer, and you ask him, what happens if I trace one cycle of energy, call it voltage, call it current, call it joules, call it whatever you want, one cycle of energy going down the transmission line, and it comes to the end of the transmission line and hits the dipole, and you ask him, what happens next? And because of his victimization of the crazy training we all receive by way of the courses we take and the books that we read, the victimization that we've experienced makes the average seasoned antenna engineer in that environment with my puzzle to usually say, why the hell do I want to know that? And my answer is, you don't want to know how the most basic of all antennas does its radiating? You don't want to know that? You've never been curious? That's where the rubber meets the road. That's where it all starts. Once you understand what's happening at the molecular level on that most important of all antenna types, you then know how to modify it for your particular environment and keep it working. You know what is vital and what is not vital for it to work correctly. You really want to know that. If you've got curiosity and you want to know how antennas work at all, that's step number one. You don't want to know about step number one. Craziness. They have all been victimized. It's when I... Let me drop... In my mind, with me, this all began roughly 2002. I had a client that forced me to build a dipole-like antenna in an extremely small package. He was really pushing the state of the art. And I had to find out what the hell was going on. How in the world could I do it? I was using all the tricks in my book of coiling the wire and putting in loading coils, top hat capacitors, and zigzagging it, curving it around the corners, forcing it to fit inside of the package. And I started studying the Brown and Woodward curves. I said, ha, I see something. You think that the average guy takes these great big Maxwell's equations and studies that equation, and he says, aha, I see what's happening? No way in hell. That's not where it happens. You look at the real measures. Oh, boy, this is a nice noise now. Let me drop. These geniuses named Brown and Woodward in 1948 took a man-year of their life with sweeping signal generators and a slotted line and a slide rule and took a year of measurements. Every possible monopole of every possible diameter and every possible length, they made real measurements and plotted it. And all that data, real data, is on that curve. That's not somebody's simulation. Almost all these equations for a simple dipole, all these complicated equations that you see, is somebody's attempt to make a curve-fitting equation. You look at those equations and you think somebody derived that. 99% of the time, the answer is it's not a derivation. It's a curve-fitting set of equations. And the guy did a curve-fitting for a particular diameter of dipole. The Brown and Woodward curves used 40 different diameters, everything from as fat as you're likely to ever use to as skinny as you're likely to use. And as you change the diameter, the impedance changes a whole lot, both the reactive component and the resistive component a little, but the reactive component changes a whole lot as you change the diameter. Most of the modeling programs don't recognize that. Most of the modeling equations don't recognize that. The Brown and Woodward curve, that's where you're talking to the horse's mouth, if you know what I mean. That's the real data, real measurement. A hell of a lot of man hours of work went into that. And the average antenna engineer today doesn't even know those equations, those curves exist. You go to a meeting of a whole bunch of seasoned antenna engineers, and you talk about the Brown and Woodward curves in Chapter 4. Let me drop. And the biggest surprise I had is those antenna engineers came back to me and said, what chapter is that in? And who is Brown and Woodward? To which I said to myself privately, wow. How did you guys live this long without knowing that? What rock have you been living under? I was saying that to myself, of course. And that, as I said, I was saying to myself, how in the world can these guys be that naive? And as I said, I suddenly realized they are victims. They are victim of the method of education. They made the mistake of assuming the way they were given the data was the whole story. From my point of view, they were given 10% of the story, and they thought they had the whole story. The story ain't that complicated, but there's a hell of a lot more to it. You see where I'm going with that one? KC2WGB, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, I want Barry to know that it's not boring, and that's what this net is for, so he should ask those questions. This stuff is interesting, and there's a lot to be learned, a lot of information to be disseminated. I'll let it drop. I'll go on to the next one.
And by the way, let me drop. You can see why I say quite often, if you're running a company that needs an antenna engineer, and you want a real, practical antenna engineer, you better hire an enthusiastic ham radio operator. I have, on a couple of occasions, worked with people who had a mountain of book learning, doctorate degree in antenna engineering, and I hit them with some of my puzzles, and I was disappointed. You can go to some of the really good schools, you could get very high degrees with specialization in communications, with a real specialization in antenna design, and the way we teach that subject in our schools, at least in the United States that I know about, leaves a lot to be desired. You really want the guy who knows how to do it, you better hire a ham. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
NY2HF, what a comment.
Go ahead, Dennis.
Dick, I've heard you talk about this issue many times, and I think you're probably spot on. with what you're saying. Do you ever think of trying to put together a online course that would force the engineers to recognize that they can't just sell a product, they have to find out what happens after people receive it, meaning they have to not just find out what goes on when it's sending the transmission down the line, but how it radiates. Do you ever think of doing something like that? Over to Ned.
Oh, yes, I have. And Eric is pressing me quite hard to do that. And I have taken the first step. If you go to Bernie's website, K2 Yankee Oscar, and his website is bernie@huntfamily.com. Go to bernie@huntfamily.com. You will see a, what is it now, 500-word paper that I submitted there called Dissecting a Dipole. So the first step in that process, dissecting a dipole, is in that location. You go to Bernie's website and you can see a copy of it. And if you have any trouble getting it, I can send it to you directly by email as I see it. Oh boy, I'm terrible. Dennis, I keep confusing Lou and Dennis because your call letters are so similar. So I've taken the first step. Mentally, I'm planning to give a presentation to the IEEE Long Island Consultants Network. Let me drop it. The IEEE Long Island Consultants Network, of which I'm a member for the last 13 years, has roughly 40 consulting engineers. Of those 40 consulting engineers, the vast majority of them are what I call computer mavens, software mavens. But three or four of those guys are RF people. Those are the ones that are in demand all the time. They have, over their 20, 30, 40 years of experience, they have developed a skill that's in continuous demand. They're the guys that are working all the time. Only three or four of them out of 40 guys. And of those three and four, only some of them have partial understanding of how a dipole works. So I'm about to give those guys a presentation, which I think I'm going to call The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly of Antenna Engineering Education. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly of Antennas, or Antenna Engineering Education, or of Antenna Education. Because there's a lot of bad and ugly, and not very much good, from my point of view, when it comes to understanding how it really works, how to make it work better, how to adapt it to your particular environment. Once you understand what's really going on, that the fact that signal is bouncing back and forth 20 times on that dipole before it gets radiated. Let me drop the code. And what we call resonance is making it the right electrical length so that those 20 bounces are all in step with each other. They're all co-phase. That's what resonance is. Once you understand the energy you put into the dipole doesn't enter the dipole and just jump into space. Absolutely not. 5% of it jumps into space on the first pass down the dipole. It gets to the end, bounces back, another 5% radiates. It takes 20 bounces to radiate that signal. And resonance is making sure all those bounces are in step with each other. That gives you a current multiplication. If the dipole has a Q of 20, that means it's going to make 20 bounces. That means the current flowing in the dipole is 20 times higher than the current you launched with the transmission line. The current being 20 times higher makes 20 times higher RF magnetic field. That's what does the radiating, the strong magnetic field. You make the dipole too short. Let me drop. You make the dipole too short, physically, but you re-resonate it electronically. Because there is less exposed wire to space, less than 5% gets radiated, maybe only 2%. So therefore, instead of 20 bounces, it will be 40 bounces or 60 bounces. That's what higher Q means. When you shorten up the dipole, it takes more bounces for that signal to finally be radiated because there's less area of the antenna exposed to space. That little bit of smaller wire with a higher number of bounces, the higher Q, has got a stronger magnetic field, therefore it can still radiate 98% of all that energy. That's what's really happening. No book says that. I'm amazed. I'm amazed at how little curiosity all these zillions of engineers all of these years have not had. Question. Didn't they really care about their business to know whether or not they are curious about what's really happening? Didn't they want to understand it? If I'm working with something as a profession, and that's with putting bread on my table, and I want to keep putting bread on the table, I want to know what the heck I'm doing. I want to know how it works. What is Mother Nature telling me? What is the real story? Go ahead, Wes, N2XJN, K2LAW.
Dick, first point of order.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
As was pointed out to me by Ham, Mike, when you mention Bernie's website, you also have to tell them they have to acquire an access to get to the Dropbox. So they have to email Bernie their email address, and he will give them the article that will allow them to access that information. He can't just go on the website and read it. Just wanted to let you know that so you can mention that when you point to Bernie's website. KC2WGB.
I got a question on that one.
Go ahead.
If I use the website address, Bernie@huntfamily.com, and is that the way I mail a email to Bernie saying, please add me to the list, give me the access? So, in other words, you still use the same email address?
That's correct, Dick. You got it.
The first one has an email address, not a website.
That's a good point. So it's an email address. You talk to Bernie saying, I'm a good guy. These are my call letters. These are my name. This is where I live. This is my email address. Please add me to the access and tell me the secret code. Is that sort of what happens, John? Go ahead.
That's it. And it will put on your screen, it'll give you a little icon, and when you click on that, it will go to Bernie's website automatically. You don't have to keep accessing it. It's very well done.
Okay. Eric, did you want to add something to that? Because as you can tell, I've given Bernie material, but I've never actually gone there to look at the material that I've given. I'm not much of a computer babe. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, well, it's actually not a website. It's actually a piece of software called Dropbox. What it is, a folder on one of Bernie's servers. And when he gives you access, it actually loads Dropbox onto your Windows system. And it's just another folder, like, any other folder that you have. Same thing in Linux. If you're using a GUI, it just becomes another folder you can open up. So it really isn't a website, and it is restricted access. And you got to ask Bernie for it, and he'll set it up for you.
My comment? My question?
Yeah, we're going to take it, Wes and then Dennis in that order. Go ahead, Wes.
What is the drug that you perform for balances with the high Q? That's the first question. The second question is, we have a high current, we got to have to have a low voltage. We got to have to give something to get the same power equation, N2XJ.
You've used good common sense, and you're using Kirchhoff's law. An antenna does not obey Kirchhoff's law. It only obeys Faraday's law. And that first article that I'm talking about, that's on Bernie's site, tries to explain that. It was Walter Lewin's article that you brought to our attention that made that clear. One of the Walter Lewin MIT physics presentations shows you the incongruity or the craziness of Kirchhoff's law versus Faraday's law. That the exact same piece of wire has a certain current flowing into it, and you try to evaluate that current by Kirchhoff's law. When there's a local magnetic field, you will come up with the wrong answer. I can have a piece of 70-ohm transmission line. Let me drop. I can have a piece of 70-ohm transmission line feeding a real 70-ohm impedance dipole resonant antenna. I put 72 volts on that transmission line. 1 ampere will flow on that transmission line. So the transmission line is developing 1 ampere of current at 72 volts, and it's feeding a resonant dipole, and the dipole has